I should introduce myself. I'm Stephen Eubank. I'm also a PI along with Travis and Chris on a MIDAS research project. I'm from the Virginia Bioinformatics Institute. My background is actually in physics, and I've been a modeler of all kinds of systems ranging from financial markets to ecologies to natural language. For the last 11 or 12 years, I've been doing computational epidemiology of infectious diseases. So I've seen the light. I can see what modeling something that has actual benefits to public health is all about. So I have no relationships to disclose with any commercial interests, and I'll just launch in here. So I want to say that infectious disease modeling underwent some big changes in the last century, and that if you know anything about modeling, and it's already come up here, you've heard modelers talk about the reproductive rate or the reproductive number, or R-naught, as they usually call it. And these kinds of models have been very important in the development of an understanding of how disease transmission works. And they're associated with names like that we've heard here, Ross McDonald, Kermack, McKendrick, Reed and Frost, stemming from quite a while ago. One of the most important things that they recognized in the transmission process was that this possibility of a nonlinear response, as we would call it in dynamical terms, or herd immunity, as most people are more familiar with it. And the point of the nonlinearity is that for a small intervention, you can achieve a much greater reduction in disease than you might have expected. And this is just an example of the way modeling can shift your perspective on some aspects. So I don't want to minimize the importance of this kind of modeling. From these more traditional kinds of epidemiological models, you'll see results like this, typically smooth curves. Maybe some of them are a little bit more bumpy, of numbers of infected people versus time. And what I want to argue is that now we have a system science perspective, which has produced different styles of models that give us different information about the system. The kinds of models I'm most familiar with are agent-based simulations, which can simulate the interactions of a lot of different kinds of parts that include aspects of society, behavior, the environment, demographics, an enormous range of things that you can add into the model, because not just for the sake of adding them in, but because they're important, they're crucial to understanding how the real system works. I like to think of this as letting you compare apples to oranges. So we can compare, for example, a non-pharmaceutical intervention to a pharmaceutical intervention. We can compare keeping people home from school with providing antivirals days earlier. I know you're not supposed to compare apples and oranges, but sometimes you have to, and this is one way that you can get away with it. And the results that we get out of these models look like this. Now, you might look at this and think, well, that's a 100-year step backwards, because we're seeing Jon Snow's map of cholera instead of those nice curves of number of people infected. But what we can do is build these kinds of data sets in the computer without anyone ever being exposed or infected, and understand how the system works in ways that are just rife with detail. You can go into the results of these models and analyze them by socioeconomic status, by geography, almost anything you want, and understand how things move through the system. So I'd like to explain some ways that I think models can be really useful in public health practice. And down at the bottom there are some examples of documents that MIDAS has had input into that may have affected you in the practice of public health or just you personally. So an obvious one that we've talked about here is outbreak response. And as I mentioned, we can deal with both non-pharmaceutical and pharmaceutical interventions. We can combine them in all kinds of ways. We can have geographically distributed starting days for the interventions. We can look at specific regions. So we can say, what happens if you apply this intervention to your town, to San Francisco, to the Mission District? We can just we can parse up, divide up the system almost any way you want it. We can look at very dynamic kinds of interventions where you apply something for a while, you change your mind and do something different, you change your mind again, do something different, you relax the controls you've imposed. All these things are very easy to do now. Another big area that I'll give one example of each of these things in a minute is surveillance, and we like to call it in silico surveillance, the computer being the silico. And I'll show you how we can not only look at the probability that you'll detect an outbreak, but we can see how this way the system is designed affects that probability. Another one that I'm just really beginning to understand is how we can help in training and educating people to make better decisions in public health. So here's an example of modeling outbreaks and how we can see how they vary by region. So these are different, these are epidemic curves, so the number of people who are infected as a function of time for several different counties in Washington State. And the point of this is just that they look different. And you might look at that as a modeler and say, okay, that's interesting. But I think the real benefit from these kinds of models is that you can look at it as a public health person and extrapolate back to the causes of those differences. We can say things like, is the density of households in this area that have more than 2.4 people, more than two people in them, sufficient to produce a curve that looks like this rather than like that?
Uh-oh.
Disaster, I didn't start my clock. Good, you got me. Okay. So for surveillance, I'm going to talk, and Brian Lewis has done a lot of this work, actually. I'm stealing slides from him as well as others in the group. So the question for a lot of surveillance systems is how you set the detection threshold so that you detect an outbreak early on, but you don't get a lot of false alarms that just drive everybody crazy. If you have too many false alarms, no one will use the system because it's not cost effective to chase after the false alarms. The problem has been setting the threshold is difficult because it's hard to detect an outbreak against the kinds of background infections that we typically have. If a lot of things are presenting as an influenza-like illness, how do you detect a small cluster of cases given the background of influenza-like illness all across the city? So what we've done is to generate a model that produces things that look like influenza-like illness. It's not a disease, but it's something we can model, the incidence of people showing up at clinics with something that looks like influenza. We can take those, and it doesn't look the same every year. The picture on the left shows you some backgrounds, and you can see that, say, the blue curves don't have as high a peak in the first year as the red curves do. It's all from the same model. We can take these things and insert an epidemic that we suspect happened in data or that we want to generate and see if we can detect anywhere we want. We can do this over and over and develop really good statistics about how this system works. What's more, we can simulate the surveillance system itself. We can say, well, suppose we had Sentinel clinics in these places, or suppose we used health insurance data. What are the time delays involved? What's the distribution of people showing up? How does that affect the way we detect an outbreak? And we can go through all this and use it to design I won't say optimal, but a better surveillance system. So the last item I had on how models can inform public health decisions. This is an example of an interface that we've developed jointly with people in the School of Public Health at the University of Utah. And I don't expect you to be able to read anything that's up there. I just want you to see that this is a bunch of tools that take the simulation results and give you the kinds of things you might have as an epidemiologist, a district epidemiologist. So there's a line listing of who's ill, how old are they, where do they live. There is, I think, something that lets you find the epidemiological links. You know, this person was at the same place as that person, and it looks like a contact that could reasonably have led to this transmission. You can look at the graphs of counts by time. You can zoom in on any of this. You can see on a map where the infection is going. And you can, what we're building now is a way to reach into this and apply interventions at arbitrary times. So you can go back and say, well, maybe this wasn't the right thing to have done. Maybe I should have done that other thing. And it's all in the computer, so you don't have to spend a lot of money trying to figure out what the best thing to have done was. You can let people go through this training over and over again with no problem. MIDAS up till now has focused really at the federal level and the international level largely. Some of the more recent research projects have expanded that. But we've worked with all these agencies that I've listed here, and it's a Washington kind of alphabet soup, but I think most of them would be familiar to you. We have recently started to penetrate into state and local level public health. So one group works with, it's generally that research groups work with their local region, at least, their state, their local providers. So we have groups working with Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, with King County in Washington, with LA County, Brandon here, and New York City, Milwaukee, the state of Texas. I think there's some really interesting projects going on in Chester County, Pennsylvania. So we're not only looking at the human health consequences of attacks on animal populations, but we're looking at the mental health consequences of one of the things that we recommend often is social distancing in a pandemic. So we're not confined strictly to modeling transmission of disease is one of the points from human to human, something like that. So these are the kinds of interactions that are really valuable to us as modelers to learn more about the questions that are important to you. And I'm trying to find a way to expand these interactions. So here's some examples of work that we did for the H1N1 pandemic. It turns out that a lot of the research groups have models that are well-tuned for respiratory disease transmission. So we've done quite a bit of work in influenza. So we modeled what happens if you change the rate of production of vaccine, how the peak timing of the epidemic interacts with the peak timing of vaccine production. We've looked at school closure policies. There was a question from HHS about possibly providing antivirals intravenously, I think for treatment, I hope, as opposed to prophylaxis. And overall, just what is the demand for healthcare? How is it likely that we would overrun the resources available to us? So, in fact, this slide is courtesy of Brandon in LA. These were some of the questions that they wanted to find the answers to from their local modeler, Ira Longini and Betz Halloran. And you can see that they're questions that are specific to his region, but they're questions that are probably common to many public health agencies. I won't read through them. I think you can all read them fine. It's very similar kinds of questions. I wanted to give a short platform here. Since I'm channeling a lot of people today, I'll channel Mark Lipsitch from the Harvard School of Public Health, I believe, or Brigham and Women's Hospital. on personal perspectives. Mark was embedded with the CDC during part of the H1N1 pandemic as part of something called Team B. He also participated in advising the President's Council on the PCAST group, Science and Technology Advisors. He pointed out that the modelers not only prevented technical skills, but because they didn't have day-to-day responsibilities for gathering data, understanding it, making decisions, they could provide a perspective that was sometimes lacking within the organization itself. He also mentioned that just general quantitative analysis of data was a role that the modelers played in these organizations because everyone was so busy. They had hardly any time to step back and take a look at the data they were gathering. He emphasized the need to look at multiple scenarios, not just one scenario, to help focus planning. And again, the importance of variation across the nation in experiences and why that requires multiple scenarios for planning. It turned out that the modeling that was going on was useful. It wasn't predicting anything in great detail, but it was useful. Okay. And a couple of themes that are going to show up, that have shown up, is that collaboration before the next event really is going to pay off. Let's do this work in advance because it may take more time than you expect. Again, Brandon Dean was looking at, I don't know whether these were desired improved collaborations or things that they actually managed to implement during their work with IRA. But I just wanted to point out the first two, increasing the accessibility of both groups and identifying the areas of and facilitating the interaction between the planners and the public health people. I'll skip that one. So I want to give you a sort of consumer's reports. How do you choose a modeler? These are some of the things that should work as warning signs. Run away from them if you see them, and things that really are better. So if somebody says they've got a one-size-fits-all model for you in this day and age, that I would discount that. It should be possible to tailor models to your circumstances and get results that are immediately applicable to your circumstances. This one is, it's fine for a service organization that, you know, it exhibits the difficult we do immediately, the impossible takes a little longer, it's drive and it's wonderful. However, if you're trying to build a model and someone says, just trust us, we can do things that are impossible and it's just magic all back here, you don't need to know anything about it, that's, in my opinion, is not a good attitude. The more transparency there is in how the models are built and used, the more confidence you'll have in the eventual outcome from it. I guess this cartoon is very old. Maybe people haven't seen it, but it's the what it says in the middle of the blackboard is, then a miracle occurs. Actually, Travis pointed this one out to me, although he doesn't recognize the spherical cow. The spherical cow is an old physics joke. You take a system and simplify it down so much that it bears no resemblance to the original system, but you can answer the questions about it. So you should expect modelers to make simplifications. We can't model the entire world out there for you. But the simplifications that we make should reflect public health understanding of how things work and not be done simply for mathematical or computational convenience. That's been the big revolution in the last couple of decades, is that we have the computing power to solve all kinds of things that we couldn't have approached a long time ago. I think this may be the last one of my tips. This thing is, as I mentioned at the beginning, MIDAS is a research program. Modeling still has large aspects of art to it. It's not to say that the models aren't scientific, it's just true that you really need to understand what you're doing. We're not going to come to you and say, I've done this a million times and here's the answer and take it or leave it. You need to work with us, you need to expect us to provide creative solutions to your problems. This one is the last one. So You'll often hear modelers say all models are wrong. This is a quote we like to use. It's only half the quote, though. And if you only hear this part, you'll go away thinking, well, if everything's wrong, why do I want to bother listening to them? The reason is that the rest of the quote, some of the models can be useful. And that's where the hope for the potential of modeling comes from. So I think I'm way over time. I'll just say that this is where you can find the right people. I don't know if the booths are even still up, but we have a booth over at the Convention Center, 2607. Stop by if you're interested in training to work with any of the research groups or just want to talk about models with us.